Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Johnny Nazarian, Education Program Manager at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Johnny Nazarian, my pronouns are they, them, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop titled Advances in the Treatment of Cervical Cancer. And this activity was made possible through an independent grant from Merck & Company, Inc., and I really want to thank them for the support of today's program. Now to start, I just want to let you all know how many people we have on the call. We have over 150 participants, primarily from the United States, from rural, urban, suburban, and frontier communities. We also have a number of international participants from Canada and the Philippines, so it is a global call. We are delighted to have all of you on this program today and that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. Now, I'm going to introduce our first speaker, and our first speaker is Dr. Mark Einstein, and Dr. Einstein is Chair of Obstetrics and Gynecology and Women's Health, Montefiore Medical Center, Professor and the Chela and Moise Safra Endowed Chair of Obstetrics and Gynecology and Women's Health, Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And Dr. Einstein will be discussing an overview of cervical cancer, including diagnosis and staging, how precision medicine and testing inform your treatment decisions, as well as biomarkers, diagnostic technologies, and sequencing of treatments. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Einstein.
Thank you so much, and thank you all for joining us today. It's wonderful to have you here that want to be empowered with more information to help others, to help your family, to help your community, and it's great, and we hope that we can provide you with a lot of good information. Cervical cancer, unfortunately, remains one of the most common cancers globally, okay? And when I say that, it's because it has to do with screening. The places where cervical cancer can be screened for has a relatively low incidence of cervical cancer, all right? And that's typically in areas that have good healthcare infrastructure of the world. But in low-income countries, such as a lot of countries in sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia, screening remains something that is unattainable due to limited resources, limited health-related resources per capita. And as a result of that, cervical cancer still remains at a very high rate. Most recently, the World Health Organization has come up with a cervical cancer elimination plan because with good prevention techniques, we actually can stop cervical cancer. As one of the great American forefathers, Ben Franklin, had said, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure when it comes to cervical cancer. And largely, we could prevent cervical cancer. We have the tools now. We have primary prevention with a highly effective vaccine that is a cervical cancer vaccine that targets the target that almost all cervical cancer has to start with, and that's infection with a very, very common virus called HPV that I'll briefly talk a little bit about later. In addition to primary prevention, we have secondary prevention with screening, and many of you have heard of a Pap test. Hopefully many of you who are eligible have received a Pap test. That has been what's going on for a long time, but now we have transitioned to the paradigm to much new screening. In fact, we can now even eliminate the role of a provider in the screening and go to self-sampling, and I will talk a little bit about that. And then effective treatment if we do identify the precancer or cancer. And the treatment for precancer is highly effective. In the U.S., these are office-based procedures, typically called the LEAP, which is a loop electroexcisional procedure, where we essentially shave off the abnormal cells in the office, or a cone biopsy. either way, with these mechanisms, we could actually prevent cervical cancer. And we've been doing PAPs now since, the late 40s in the United States. And we have a voluntary screening program, but a lot of the services in this country allow for very easy access to PAP testing. But what we've learned over the years is that we could actually be much more efficient with identifying those people that are at risk and potentially cut down on unnecessary procedures that could cause pain and anxiety in individuals. These procedures are called colposcopy. And the way we're doing this is with these new molecular markers, one of them being HPV. Not only can we diagnose HPV, which again is incredibly common, but we can identify like kind of how risky that HPV type is. There's a lot of different types. There's about 40 HPV types that infect the genital tract. And by the way, there are papillomaviruses across mammalian species. There are avian and bovine papillomaviruses, and all of them have survived. We actually did a study with the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, and we've identified papillomaviruses sequences in dinosaurs. So this has been going on for millions of years. And why is it? Why does it go on? Well, because it's a virus that knows how to hide from the immune system. All right. When someone, gets a virus, a lot of times they get sick. You get a rhinovirus, you get a cold. You get hepatitis, boy, you get sick. You get COVID, yeah, most of the time you get sick. But this virus, if you get this virus, it's uncommonly you get sick. There are no symptoms to this virus. Okay. And as a result of that, it can hide very dormant, right? And it could cause its damage without it being recognized by the individual who's infected with HPV, okay? And that's why it's important to get screening. Now we're trying to make screening easier because not only does it potentially cause cervical cancer, but we have very highly effective and very, very sensitive testing to identify HPV, okay? And what we've been doing is we oftentimes do the HPV test with the PAP test. But what we've learned is why not start with just the more sensitive test? And in some cases, do the less sensitive test, which is cytology, which is essentially removing just doing a blind sweep of the abnormal of cells on the tip of the cervix. Okay. And as a result of that, we can now be highly efficient. And in fact, for most people, we don't even need to do it more frequently than even every 5 years. When I started with my career, we used to do annual PAPs. And it didn't increase the amount of cervical cancer patients that we picked up, but it just increased the amount of unnecessary procedures that people were suffering from. So it makes a lot of sense to now go to these more efficient strategies. And now, in this past year, we now have a very novel approach to screening, and that's using self-sampling, where we could literally take a dry swab, a Q-tip that looks the same type as the thing as a Q-tip that you put in your ear or your nose, but it's a special type of Q-tip that goes into a special container. And from that, we could get an HPV test, okay, just from a dry swab, all right, something you could roll around in the vagina for about 30 seconds, okay? And it's very simple to do. I think the real benefit of this is not only can you do this now for some of these tests at home, if your physician's office is or clinician's office is available to be able to do this, but you could do it in non-traditional settings. Some of the things that we're doing locally is we're actually now starting to do self-sampling screening in our emergency rooms or in a family medicine clinic that doesn't routinely do GYN exams. And why is this important? Well, about half of individuals that get cervical cancer today have seen a doctor in the last 5 years, have had some sort of screening, but not have been connected to management. I can't tell you how many times I see someone that presents to my office with cervical cancer, and unfortunately, they've seen like 10, 12 doctors over the last 10 years, and nobody's thought about doing cervical cancer screening. So part of us giving you this information is to advocate for yourselves, advocate for your family, advocate for others to ask for a cervical cancer test so that you can get screened, so we can pick it up when it's easily treatable and easily curable. I don't want to dominate the conversation, but I'm certainly happy to expand on any of the things I spoke about at our Q&A session. I'm going to hand it back over to our MC. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Einstein. All right, and our next speaker is Dr. Grace Dunick, and Dr. Dunick is Assistant Professor, Gynecologic Oncology, at the University of Oklahoma Health Campus, and Dr. Dunick will be discussing combination treatments, new and emerging treatment approaches, updates on clinical trials, how research increases treatment options, as well as the role of the pathologist. It's now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Dunick.
Thank you so much for that introduction. I appreciate it, and thank you guys for having me this afternoon. I would like to start by talking about combination therapy. I think where combination treatments are currently most prevalent and becoming increasingly so is in the realm of treating locally advanced cervical cancer. Locally advanced means that the cancer is too big for surgery, and it may invade the bladder or rectum, but there's no evidence of what we call metastatic disease or spread outside of the pelvis. We then typically proceed with a combination of chemotherapy and radiation. But there are several trials that have recently changed the way that we administer this treatment. Historically, we've administered a chemotherapeutic agent called cisplatin on a weekly basis in conjunction with external and internal radiation. In 2024, there was a paper entitled Interlace that was published, and this trial evaluated 500 patients with locally advanced cervical cancer and tested whether 6 weeks of what we call induction chemotherapy with two agents that are commonly used in GYN cancer, carboplatin and paclitaxel, before our standard chemoradiation, improved outcomes compared with chemoradiation alone. The investigators of this trial did find that induction chemotherapy improved progression-free survival and overall survival in this trial. So this has moved into the forefront of how we are treating our locally advanced cancers today. The use of immunotherapy has also been an up-and-coming area of excitement in the world of gynecologic cancer. A recent trial entitled KEYNOTE-A18 was published also in 2024, and this trial evaluated patients who had newly diagnosed more high-risk locally advanced cervical cancer and evaluated the addition of an immunotherapy agent called pembrolizumab to this standard cisplatin-based chemoradiation, followed by maintenance pembrolizumab after the radiation was concluded. This study also demonstrated a significant improvement in survival compared with chemoradiation alone. So we have these two trials. They came out at similar times. How have we best known which regimen is best for which patient? We looked primarily at the population. The Interlace trial had patients who had earlier stage lower risk disease, whereas the population of A18 was comprised of patients who had later stage disease. And so that's how we have assigned our treatments. The patients who have earlier stage disease proceed with an induction chemotherapy, and our patients with higher risk later stage disease, we utilize the A18 regimen with immunotherapy. What we are looking into now is, can we combine these two regimens and get even better results, better survival? Is more in this regard? We currently have a clinical trial open nationwide, including at our site in the University of Oklahoma, called GY037. Recently opened, it's actively enrolling patients, and it's looking at the same patient population with higher risk locally advanced cervical cancer, and comparing the induction chemotherapy with carboplatin and paclitaxel along with the addition of pembrolizumab, followed by pembrolizumab-based chemoradiation with the pembrolizumab maintenance following, versus the pembrolizumab-based chemoradiation followed by pembrolizumab maintenance, similar to the regimen used in A18. The study is designed essentially to test whether adding upfront chemotherapy and immunotherapy can improve progression-free survival and overall outcomes beyond that benefit that we've already seen with the KEYNOTE-A18 trial. So that's how we treat our locally advanced cervical cancer currently, recently informed by these two major clinical trials that have changed the landscape of our treatment, which reinforces the importance of clinical trials. So how are we treating cancer that is metastatic or that has come back, which is what we call recurrent? We do have some updated additions to our armamentarium here as well, driven by several recent trials. Historically, we've treated metastatic or recurrent cervical cancer with chemotherapy alone or with a combination of chemotherapy and immunotherapy. In July of 2024, so 2 years ago, there was an additional trial published evaluating a drug called tisotumab, or the brand name that you may have heard is called Tivdak. Tisotumab is what's called an antibody drug conjugate, or ADC for short. An ADC is a type of targeted cancer therapy. So it combines a monoclonal antibody with a powerful chemotherapy drug. And the antibody acts like a homing device of sorts, recognizing and attaching to an antigen that lives on cancer cells. In this case, for tisotumab, the antigen is called tissue factor, and that's a protein that's commonly found on the cells of cervical cancer. Once attached, the cancer cell actually pulls that drug inside, and the chemotherapy is released and destroys the cells by preventing it from dividing further. And compared with traditional chemotherapy, which circulates throughout the body, affects cancerous and healthy cells, an ADC, or antibody drug conjugate, is designed to deliver treatment more directly to the cancer cells, improving effectiveness while potentially reducing some side effects. In simple terms, it works like a guided delivery system carrying chemotherapy specifically to cancer cells rather than exposing the entire body to the same level of treatment. So to return to the trial, the investigators evaluated this drug, tisotumab, versus single-agent chemotherapies, and they did find a significant improvement in progression-free survival and overall survival, as well as increased response rate in the recurrent setting, demonstrating with tisotumab that this was the first ADC that we saw that made a statistically significant improvement in survival over our standard chemotherapy, making it an important standard of care option in the second line setting. I wanted to turn our attention briefly and talk about some upcoming trials for both metastatic and recurrent cervical cancer. There is a big focus today, not just on cervical cancer, but on GYN cancer in general, on other ADCs. There is an ongoing phase 2 trial of a drug called sacituzumab govitecan, enrolling patients with cancer that has come back after original chemotherapy. Sacituzumab govitecan is also an ADC. It targets an antigen called TROP2 and delivers the chemotherapy directly to the cancer cells. This study is evaluating the tumor response as well as progression-free survival, overall survival, and safety of this drug, as well as the relationship between the expression of TROP2 in each person and treatment benefit. Because TROP2 is highly expressed in many cervical cancers, and ADCs like tisotumab have already demonstrated clinical benefit in this disease, many of us hope and view this trial as another important test of whether the ADC platform can improve outcomes for patients who have either metastatic cervical cancer or recurrent. In terms of trials, I also wanted to discuss an HPV-targeted immunotherapy clinical trial called PRGN-2009. These types of studies are especially important in cervical cancer because as Dr. Einstein mentioned, HPV is the cause of nearly all cases of cervical cancer. And unlike many cancers, cervical cancers continue to produce HPV proteins that help the cancer to survive. That actually gives researchers a clear target that is largely absent from healthy cells. So HPV-targeted immunotherapies are designed to train the immune system to recognize and attack cancer cells carrying these viral proteins. This approach may be more precise than traditional chemotherapy because it focuses on a feature unique to the cancer. It's also different than the preventative HPV vaccines like Gardasil, which help prevent HPV infection rather than treat existing cancers. These studies are particularly important because while we do have immunotherapy drugs like pembrolizumab, and as mentioned before, ADCs such as tisotumab that have improved outcomes for some patients, there are many cancers that eventually stop responding. So we hope that these HPV-targeted therapies can generate a stronger immune response and help overcome resistance to treatment. The trial I referenced earlier, PRGN-2009, is an investigational immunotherapy that's designed to help the immune system attack cancer cells that express HPV-16 or HPV-18, which are the virus types responsible for most cervical cancers. This is a phase 2 trial, and they're evaluating whether adding this HPV-targeted therapy to pembrolizumab, which we already utilize, improves outcomes for patients with metastatic or recurrent cervical cancer that has become resistant to pembrolizumab. This study is actually now closed to enrollment, but we are waiting the results. They're expected to report in approximately 2030. In summary, even with just this very short discussion of only a few trials, you can clearly appreciate how research and clinical trials have dramatically expanded treatment options for patients with cervical cancer by introducing more effective combination therapies and novel targeted approaches across both locally advanced as well as metastatic disease. These advances highlight how clinical research continues to transform cervical cancer care by providing patients with more effective, individualized, and innovative treatment options. Lastly, I wanted to touch on the role of the pathologist in cervical cancer. Pathologists play a central role for us in the diagnosis and classification of cervical cancer by examining tissue samples that are obtained from biopsies, excisions, or surgical resections. They determine whether abnormal cells that are present represent precancerous changes or an invasive cancer, and if so, to identify the specific type of cancer, most commonly squamous cell carcinoma or adenocarcinoma. They also assess key features like tumor grade, depth of invasion, lymphovascular space invasion, margin status, which help us determine stage and guide our treatment decisions, particularly in early stage diseases where surgery alone may be curative. In addition to diagnosis and staging, modern cervical cancer care, as we've discussed, increasingly relies on pathologists to provide molecular and biomarker testing that directly influences our treatment selection. This includes testing for HPV status, which confirms the viral-driven origin of most cervical cancers, as well as evaluating biomarkers like PD-L1 expression to determine eligibility for immunotherapy like pembrolizumab. Pathologists also may assess emerging targets such as HER2 or tissue factor, which helps us delineate patients who may benefit from antibody drug conjugates or additional clinical trials. In this way, pathologists have really evolved from providing a purely diagnostic role to becoming a key member of our oncology team, helping us to personalize therapy and connect patients to the most appropriate and advanced treatment options. That concludes my portion of the talk. Again, I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dunick. And our next speaker is Ms. Nikki Molfettis. And Ms. Molfettis is an oncology social worker as well as New Jersey program coordinator here at Cancer Care. And Ms. Molfettis will be discussing Cancer Care's free programs and services as well as our helpline and website. It's now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Molfettis.
Thank you so much. Thank you to the other speakers and everyone who's here today. Welcome. My name is Nikki Molfettis. I am the New Jersey Program Coordinator as well as an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling, support groups, educational workshops like this one today, publications, and then limited financial assistance as well. There are many aspects of a cancer diagnosis that may be addressed throughout psychosocial supportive services, making informed treatment decisions, quality of life concerns, clinical trials, fertility options, and communication with one's medical team are important topics that can be discussed with an oncology social worker. Individuals may choose to supplement their existing social networks by choosing to join a support group or engage in counseling services. Many hospitals, treatment centers, and nonprofit organizations offer supportive services. Being a member in a support group can offer the opportunity to connect with others who are going through a similar situation, obtain information, and provide support. Our online support groups take place on a password-protected website and are moderated by licensed oncology social workers who can offer further support and guidance. You can register for an online support group through our website at cancercare.org. We also offer resource navigation. This service is offered nationally to patients, post-treatment survivors, and caregivers affected by cancer. It's a short-term, strengths-based approach to case management where the social worker will connect with the client in connecting them to resources, referrals, and financial assistance. Individuals may also experience practical and financial concerns throughout their treatment. Please note that if you are encouraging these hardships, there are organizations that are out there to help you. As mentioned earlier, CancerCare offers resource navigation services as well as the limited financial assistance. If you are navigating any practical or financial concerns, I encourage you to call our national helpline at 1-800-813-4673 to speak to one of our oncology social workers. We're here to offer you support throughout this experience and are looking forward to speaking with you soon. It's been such a pleasure being part of this program. I'll now turn it back to you, Ms. Nazarian. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Moffettis. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A. We're going to take as many of your questions as possible. I'm going to ask Bella to explain to you how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
Thank you. One question here for Dr. Einstein. Are there specific populations at higher risk for cervical cancer? If so, are there guidelines in place to address this?
That's an excellent question. Thank you very much for asking that. So yes, there are certain populations that are at higher risk, those people that have a depressed immune system, such as individuals living with HIV, transplant patients, individuals that might be taking exogenous immune modulators for things like lupus or ulcerative colitis or uveitis. And all of these individuals, if anything, we err on the side of a little bit more aggressive screening for them. In addition, an individual who has had other types of HPV-associated anogenital lesions, such as the same kind of cell changes can happen in the vagina, can happen in the vulva, can happen in the anus or around the anus. And individuals that have had any of those areas that also have had either precancerous cells or even cancer are at risk for cervical cancer. And as a result of that, these individuals, we don't really call it screening anymore. We kind of call it active surveillance, where we are much more aggressive about management. In addition, an individual who has had treatment for a prior precancerous lesion of the cervix is at four times the risk of the rest of the population of actually having cervical cancer. So those individuals also, we don't really screen. We really are just actively bringing them back on a regular basis. And, yeah, there are guidelines for each of them. So for individuals, for instance, living with HIV, the CDC Opportunistic Infection HPV guidelines, I'm a member of those guidelines. And the guidelines are pretty similar to what we would do in non-immunosuppressed, but we err a little bit on the side of being more frequent with regards to screening. There are no active guidelines for individuals that are on autoimmune-related or immune modulators right now, but in general, those individuals are screened at least every year, if not more frequent, if they've had some sort of abnormality in the past.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Einstein. question here for Dr. Dunick. Are there any specific signs or symptoms for patients to look out for after treatment in terms of relapse?
Thank you. That's a great question. Yes. So typically how I counsel my patients are any pain in the pelvis that is new or different. Vaginal bleeding certainly requires evaluation. Any evidence of like lymph node swelling in the groin, if they notice that, pain in the leg that radiates down the leg can be concerning. Losing weight in a way that's unanticipated, decreased appetite. Those are the big things that I recommend to my patients to look out for.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dunick. I have a question here for Dr. Einstein. I wanted to know how low-risk and high-risk HPV differ.
That's another good question. So right now, we have one of the HPV tests, well, a few of them that are out there, actually categorize the HPV types into more than one bucket. So you have, they're all high-risk types, like meaning all of them are associated with cervical cancer, but there are some that I'll say more risky than others, okay? So the high risk, the particularly bad high risk types are actually, Dr. Dunning had mentioned them because they're the ones that that we have actually immunotherapy targeted treatments for, and that's HPV 16 and 18. Then there's a group of about five different HPV types that we would call intermediate but high risk types. And then we have these what are more indolent or lower risk but high risk HPV types. And we actually use that what is called extended genotyping. So many providers will do extended genotyping. We use this in the triage of individuals for going to the next step, which is this procedure called a colposcopy, where we're looking with a magnifying scope and identifying the areas where there are abnormal, there might be abnormal cells that will be biopsied with essentially an instrument that biopsies a tiny bit of the cervix, no bigger than the tip of my pen. And so for those individuals that have, shall I say, the more indolent or lower risk but high risk HPV types, they're more apt to not need to get that colposcopy unless there's been a couple of consecutive tests. Whereas individuals who are infected with 16 or 18, they are to be triaged immediately to colposcopy. So those categories help us triage patients better so that only really the individuals that are most at risk of having something abnormal today will get the procedures that they need. And it safely spaces out the procedures and the need for seeing a provider for those individuals that have the more indolent or low-risk types.
Thank you very much, Dr. Einstein. I have a question here, actually for both of our doctors. Can anyone speak to the emotional impact of this common virus and how it impacts patients emotionally? Now, if Dr. Einstein, if you would like to go first, and then Dr. Dunick.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I spend a lot of time what I call talking people off the HPV ledge. Okay, what does this mean? There's this, if you start like putting into like our Dr. Google or whatever AI chat, you know, type of thing, you know, HPV, you could see a lot of that relatively, you know, kind of scary stuff that's out there. And again, that's just a summary of like sort of what's on the web. Bottom line is we have bacteria and viruses all over our body. Some of them we can't live without. This is certainly one of those things that we can live without, okay? And in a very small percent of individuals that actually are infected with HPV, we'll actually get something that's clinically relevant that needs some sort of intervention, all right? Whether it be warts, whether it be precancer, whether it be cancer, okay? The good thing is we actually now, we've actually been able to exploit the presence of HPV to be able to be more targeted in identifying individuals that are at risk. And we could do things like extended genotyping, like what I was talking about, and be able to test for it. But I think more importantly, Everyone's infected with HPV at some point in time in their life. The stats say between 80 and 85%, and on any given day, 25% of the population has an active HPV infection going on, all right? And that's for all genders, okay? So this is incredibly ubiquitous, but less than 1% of individuals that are actually infected with HPV will get something that needs an intervention. So if anything, those individuals that are suffering from an HPV-associated disease are the unfortunate few where the virus has actually been starting to cause some element of damage. So it's really, if misery likes company, just know that everyone's got this and everyone's had this in the past.
Thank you very much, Dr. Einstein. And then just wanted to ask Dr. Sona, did you have anything that you wanted to add that you see with your patients?
No, I agree with everything that Dr. Einstein has said. I just agree. I really emphasize that nearly all sexually active adults will be exposed to this virus at some point in their lives because it's so common, causes no symptoms, and most people don't know when they acquired it. So I just emphasize that it's not something that reflects on behavior, character, but it's a common viral exposure that can affect nearly anyone.
I mean, if I could just add one more thing, I mean, this is another reason why it makes a lot of sense to prevent the infection mm-hmm. with a vaccine. Okay, so we now, we have an effective, highly effective vaccine, over 20 years of utilization of the vaccine in the United States, and that has shown excellent safety and excellent efficacy, and it really has decreased the amount of disease that is already in the United States. In Australia, as a prime example, there was a very aggressive vaccination program when the vaccine first rolled out, and already 20 years later in Australia, the amount of abnormal PAPs are about a quarter of what they were before vaccination. The amount of individuals infected with genital warts are less than 10% of what they were 20 years ago. And the amount of cervical cancer has started decreasing. And in fact, in New Zealand, which also had an aggressive cervical cancer vaccine program for the first time ever, nobody in New Zealand over a month period of time got diagnosed with cervical cancer. So we could actually prevent this. And so rather than, we could be, I think, being, more aggressive with, just some of what is routinely recommended vaccination from all medical societies, including the society that both Dr. Dunnick and I belong to, the Society of Gynecologic Oncology, we can prevent this.
Great. Thank you both very much. We have another question here for Dr. Dunnick. So diagnosed with advanced cervical cancer, what are my options for preserving my fertility?
That is a good question. That is a little bit of a tough one to answer. Typically, fertility preservation is pretty challenging for patients who have a diagnosis of advanced cervical cancer. If by advanced you mean has spread outside of the pelvis, in that setting we are typically recommending chemotherapy, at which point fertility preservation is pretty challenging. There are some options. It has to be very individualized to each patient, but sometimes we are able to egg retrieval and have that option for potential gestational carrier in the future. But there, it does present a pretty significant challenge.
Great. Thank you. And then a follow-up question for that. Who can I expect to be on my healthcare team in terms of preserving fertility? Who would I? Yeah.
Yeah, so it'll be a coordinated effort between your oncologist and our reproductive endocrine infertility colleagues, so REI for short. It will be a collaborative effort between those two teams.
Thank you very much. A question here for Dr. Einstein. You discussed self-sampling. Is this expected to replace pap smears?
Yeah, good question. So less than 5% of individuals in the United States in physician offices and systems have started self-sampling. There's a lot of logistics that have to go into place to initiate that. I know we're in the middle of initiating the program at in the Bronx, where cervical cancer, unfortunately, incidence is quite high, and where we can maybe access additional people. So things have to sort of be in place from a system level. The lab workflow has to change a little bit. The actual testing has to be validated, and the collection devices also have to be distributed to the patients. From a provider level, what to do with those results? And, you know, providers for Pap tests come in many different varieties, not just like what Dr. Dunning and I do at gynecologic oncology, but OBGYNs, nurse practitioners, family medicine doctors, primary care doctors, are all screeners and all need to understand what to do with these sort of results and how to kind of interpret them, because we don't have cytology anymore. So it's a much more of a broader macro determination of what needs immediate treatment. And then from an OBGYN standpoint, there's a lot of education with regards to what to do next, because all colposcopy is going to have to be colposcopy with some element of prejudice, because we're not going to know what the cytology is. All right, so high quality colposcopy is really critically important. And then from the patient level, patients have to recognize that this is a new type of approach, but it's highly safe, it's highly effective. And I think many of us hope that with further education of the public with regards to this as a potential mode of cervical cancer screening, that more and more individuals that are not screened will get screened, so that we could prevent more cervical cancer, not only in the United States, but globally.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Einstein. We have another question here for Dr. Dunick. Where can I start to look for clinical trials?
That's a great question. One place that is, if you're wanting to just look on your own, clinicaltrials.gov has essentially catalog of all of the clinical trials that are open in the United States, and that can be very helpful for people. In addition, if you are someone who is currently receiving cancer care at a specific institution, you can also reach out to your provider there, and they may be able to provide some guidance as well. But I think clinicaltrials.gov is a nice place to start, and something that someone can do on their own if they're wanting to be proactive in that regard.
Thank you, Dr. Dunick. Another question here for Dr. Einstein. Is cervical cancer always caused by HPV?
So thank you for the question. 97% of cervical cancers have identification of some element of HPV. So essentially all of them is what I would say. I think nothing is 100%, unfortunately, in our field. In the individual types of cancers that don't have HPV, HPV might have been involved in its generation, but the sequences have kind of mutated in such an abnormal way that the HPV is sort of eliminated from it. So most are caused by HPV.
Thank you very much, Dr. Einstein. And then for Dr. Dunick, can having an STI in the past impact risk for cervical cancer?
I think in some ways, yes, because if you have had an STI in the past, there's certainly a risk of having concurrent HPV infection, but having an STI alone, such as chlamydia, gonorrhea, et cetera, does not directly translate into the development of cervical cancer. And it's also important to recognize that most people who have had HPV in the past don't develop cancer. So cervical cancer is developing when a high-risk HPV infection persists for many years and is causing progressive changes in cervical cells. So an STI on its own does not necessarily increase risk.
Great. Thank Thank you very much, Dr. Dunick. We have another question here just for both of our doctors. How would you reduce the stigma of someone with their HPV diagnosis? I know that the virus is very common, the same with oral herpes, but that has high stigma as well. I don't know if Dr. Einstein, if you would like to start first, just to address that in a general way.
Yeah, we had mentioned this before. I think with continued education of the general public with regards to the high prevalence of this, you know, this is a virus just like many other viruses, like getting a cold. This thing is picked up, and this is picked up without even necessarily penetrative sexual activity. This could be transmitted, you know, even without that. Okay, this skin to skin contact. So the bottom line is that this is just incredibly, incredibly common. I think that it's the more how we discuss it, how we talk about it, how we utilize it as a test. I think in our medical world, we're using it as a mode of empowerment. A lot of times where we are empowering our patients with the knowledge and information about the virus. This is not like gonorrhea or chlamydia or trichomonas, which if you were exposed to these things and you've gotten a new infection of one of these things, then it is a recent exposure. And that HPV type could be the same HPV type that was picked up 5 years ago, 10 years ago. In fact, there's been large prospective studies where patients have been tested for HPV over 20, 30-year periods of time. And sometimes they'll wax and wane, where on a given year they're positive and another year they're negative, but it's usually the same type. So it's unlikely that it's something that's new. It's not a new virus. In fact, a lot of times when an individual has an HPV test but has never had an abnormal in the past, it's probably because we weren't testing for it in the past. We weren't testing for this routinely 20 years ago. So just because we didn't know about it doesn't mean the tree didn't fall in the forest. The individual might have had it then, okay? So, you know, again, this is, I think, discussing this in a more of an empowering session, that we use it as a marker for screening. We use it as a marker to fight cervical cancer. We use it as a target to go after it, and we have now drugs to prevent it. So, again, a lot of tools that are focused around this to empower our patients to make sure that they don't suffer as a result of the results of HPV.
Thank you, Dr. Einstein. And Dr. Dunna, could you, anything else that you wanted to add to that question about reducing stigma?
Yes, I agree with Dr. Einstein's point of just continuing to improve our education about the ubiquity of HPV. And like he mentioned, the persistence, and us as providers utilizing language and an approach that it remains subjective and there's no blame assigned. But really, I think improving education and increasing, continuing to talk about it, educate others, and not sweeping it under the rug.
Great. Thank you both. We have one last question here for Dr. Einstein. What are the medical complications for men with HPV?
That's a good question. So as opposed to HPV, that really that infects individuals with the cervix. For males, they are in general, they don't get the same end results. Okay, they do, however, they can get anal disease, particularly men who live with HIV or immunocompromised men. They could get warts. There is an association of some types of head and neck cancers with HPV, so and this is part of the reason why we are vaccinating men as well, but also we are vaccinating men to develop what we are calling herd vaccination, which is so that we could maybe stomp out this vaccine from something that will generally affect humans, and so to protect all genders who are exposed to HPV, and by vaccinating the whole population, we could do that, but it certainly will help men, particularly for anal disease, penile warts, and for head and neck cancers.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Einstein. And now I'm just going to ask our speakers to provide their takeaways from today's workshop. We'll start with Dr. Einstein, then Dr. Dunick, and then Ms. Molfettis. So Dr. Einstein?
Sure. So, you know, we now have great tests for screening. Please use the information that you heard today and other information that you've seen to empower your community, empower your family, empower certainly female members of your family to make sure that they get screened. Screening is power. That knowledge is power to be able to prevent disease. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And also continue to broadly recommend vaccination for all. This is certainly a life-saving vaccination. In places where we have higher vaccine rates, we've already seen essentially cervical cancer being stomped out. And as much as we have a lot, as Dr. Dunning had talked to us about, we have some great treatments, we have some great trials, but treatment is not anywhere near as good as preventing this disease. And I think we will all agree on that. And I look forward to the day that I never have to see another woman suffering from cervical cancer again.
Thank you very much, Dr. Einstein and Dr. Dunick.
Thank you. I would say my key take-home points are, talk about clinical trials. They really do change the standard of care for our patients with gynecologic cancers, with cervical cancers, and many of the treatments that we use today became available because patients participated in research studies. For locally advanced cervical cancer, we know that these newer treatment approaches that add this chemotherapy, immunotherapy to radiation have improved survival and are helping patients live longer. Same is to be said for patients with recurrent or metastatic cervical cancer. With our newer targeted treatments, we're able to deliver chemotherapy directly to cancer cells and are expanding our treatment options beyond traditional chemotherapy. New researchers are actively developing new therapies, including our HPV-targeted immunotherapies, like I mentioned, and additional ADCs with the goal of making treatment more effective and personalized. So just in conclusion, that precision medicine and biomarker testing are really helping match patients to the most effective treatment and clinical trials.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dunick and Ms. Molfettis.
Yeah, I feel like kind of going off of what everyone said, there's a lot of great information provided, but reminding yourself that there's screening, there's treatment, continue to advocate for yourself, you know yourself better than anybody else. So speak with your medical team, your loved ones, and know that there's a lot of support out there for you.
Thank you very much. I just want to take a moment to thank all of our speakers. We had a really phenomenal panel today. The presentations provided, again, a lot of information, a lot of exciting news, leaving a lot of hope in terms of cervical cancer. And I also want to thank our participants. Today's program was particularly exceptional because of the questions that were asked on this call and then the way our speakers addressed those questions. I want to thank you all for being here as well. Now, I do want to say a few words, though, for those of you that didn't have your question answered, whether you were typing a question, or even if you did have your question answered, I would like you to go back to your healthcare team and ask them your question. Please remember that you've learned a great deal from today's program, and I want you to take what you've learned, go back to your treating healthcare team, and ask them your questions again and again. And then lastly, I just want to say I don't want anyone to leave this workshop feeling as if they are alone, because you are not alone. You have a community of support here at Cancer Care. Please know that we are here for you. Now, I appreciate everyone's participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.